Director Lenny?
Here.
Mellon?
Present.
Patterson?
Present.
Young? Here. President McIntosh?
Here. I have no cards for public comment, so we will reconvene in conference room 8 to discuss items 1, 2, and 3, returning here at 1:15.
Getting some
feedback. Oh, okay.
Good afternoon.
Oh.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our regular business meeting. Roll call, Madam Secretary.
Director Coleman?
Present.
Katz?
Present.
Lenny?
Here.
Mellon?
Present.
Patterson?
Present.
Young?
Here.
President McIntosh?
Here. Please join us for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The next item on our agenda are the 2018 board committee assignments. They have been amended to reflect, Reship specifically?
To reflect that Director Mellon is the representative for the Alameda County Special District Association and committee.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
I was trying to figure out what the change was.
So do we have a motion?
I'll move. Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right. Mr. General Manager, that brings us to WaterSmart Business Certification Awards.
All right. Thank you, President McIntosh, board members. Today marks the district's 8th annual WaterSmart Business Certification Award celebration, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you the award recipients certified in 2017. We have Director Doug Linney, who's going to assist with providing the awards. The WaterSmart certification program helps business customers identify and implement water-efficient measures in their facility operations. Through this process, district staff provides detailed site water use audits, analysis, and efficiency recommendations, rebate offers, and return on investment calculations, as well as training and consultations. The goal of the program is to educate and support customers to use water efficiently while maintaining a high level of productivity. In addition to today's recognition event, the district also offers to present the award at a company or industry-sponsored event upon request. This year, we added 33 new businesses for certification, all achieving outstanding water efficiency at their respective sites. To date, the WaterSmart business recipients have saved over 125 million gallons annually. Additionally, 11 businesses are being recertified for continuing their water-efficient practices. These 44 businesses have demonstrated their commitment to best water management practices and technology adoption to benefit their operations and the environment. For today's event, 18 businesses are present to receive their awards. Those unable to attend today will receive their award at a later time. At this time, we'd like to recognize the companies who are joining us today. And as I call your name, please come forward to receive your award from Director Linney. Please stay in front of the room after receiving your award for a group photo at the end of the presentation. Our first recipient is Mr. Norman Wong, Environmental Engineer with the Bay Area Rapid Transit, or BART. Captain Sharon Oliver, City of Alameda Fire Department, for the City of Alameda Mastic Senior Center, the City of Alameda Police Department, and City of Alameda Fire Department Fire Station Number 1. Ms. Lauren Westrich, owner of Every Dog Has Its Daycare. Mr. Pierre Santiago, Administrative Specialist 2 with the Alameda Healthcare Services Agency. Ms. Su Chiang, Pollution Prevention Director, Center for Environmental Health. Mr. Matthew Manival, Designer, HMC Architects. Mr. Matt Doms, owner agent, Matt Doms State Farm Insurance Agency. Ms. Tiffany Tran, Senior Sustainability Analyst at Annie's Inc. Mr. Kenneth Lowe, Office Manager, Kalamuna, LLC. Mr. Jeremy Pearson, Educator, Ecological Gardener, Bishop O'Dowd High School. Mr. Benjamin Bloom, President, Homewatch Caregivers of Oakland. Ms. Ellie Buchner, Conference Director, Green Biz Group. Mr. Kai Flash, Owner, Gaumont Skatel. Ms. Ruth Wiseman, Business Associate, Oakland Hebrew Day School. Ms. Kelly Lux, Director Owner, Kelly Lux State Farm Insurance. And finally, Mr. Kevin Kenny, Manager of the Oakland Campus of the California State University, East Bay. As part of the district's effort to maximize water efficiency, I'm also proud to announce that this year, 9 district facilities have also achieved WaterSmart certification. As you leave today, please stop by the display of all the WaterSmart certified businesses located on the wall outside of the boardroom, which is updated annually. Learn about our new winners and their accomplishments on the poster board displays outside of the boardroom. Please join me and the board in congratulating all of our 2017 WaterSmart Business Certification winners.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you all. Great job.
Thank you.
Very nice meeting.
No one wants to stay for our meeting.
You blame? Thank you, John.
There are no announcements from closed session. I do not have any speaker cards for any... Let me take that back. Orinda Water Treatment Plant, which is number 3 on the consent calendar, which we're removing at any rate. Correct, Mr. Gentleman?
Yeah, there was a request from the committee that we pull it to allow for a little further conversation.
All right. I have no speaker cards for public comment, but let's move on to the consent calendar to discuss items 1, 2, and 4. Jay, would you like to speak on this?
I'm sorry.
Let's adopt.
Let's take care of 1, 2, and 4.
Okay.
I move adoption of items 1, 2, and 4 on the consent calendar.
All right. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right. Jay, do you still wish to speak?
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Board of Directors, General Manager. I'm here on behalf of Local 2019 and its members to speak against the proposed contracting out for the Orinda Water Treatment Plant. We are okay with contracting out the ultraviolet portion and the technical and constructability review and the CFD modeling, the computational fluid dynamics modeling. However, we think that the design of the chlorine contact basin and related facilities And the permitting, startup, and commissioning should be all kept in-house. The staff can and wants to perform this work. Of my past 10 years, 11 years here, this contracting out has had the most responses from membership. I've had the most emails saying, we can do this in-house, which is significant. The concerns we have about contracting out the work is that in the future, when repairs, maintenance, which will be required, who will be the expert when that time comes? An outside for-profit consultant? We think it's better to have in-house expert staff who have vested interest in projects at the district. We're concerned that you're building a Frankenstein system. You have one contractor doing one piece here, another contractor doing there, without any cohesiveness. And if you had district staff do it, we would have that continuity. We're also concerned that you're rushing a lot of jobs. There may be too many projects in a short period of time, and that's going to increase the risks in terms of safety violations and injury. And also morale. Staff really wants to do this work. If you contract it out, it'll be a downer for the workers. So all this aside, there are two questions I think that you need to ask yourself. One is, for a critical facility, do you want a for-profit consultant to do the design or vested staff? And the second question, do you want a headache now or later? If you were to contract this out, in the short term, it'd be convenient to write a check for a consultant, have them do the work. Further down the line, there may be consequences and headaches from doing repair work, maintenance work, when there'll be no experts in the staff. If you keep the house in work, there will be some headaches at the onset. You'll have to spend some effort to revise the workload, scheduling. But in the long term, you'll have the expertise and staff when it comes time for maintenance and repair activities. So we're asking that you revise the plan for the workload and scheduling now, and we believe that management staff is capable of doing that. If you decide to contract it out, then you'll just be pushing or kicking the can down the line, and you'll have to deal with problems later when it comes time for repairs and maintenance. So the choice is yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay.
That's some questions. I'm sorry.
Can we get, I think what we were hoping, I mean, Frank, if you have, want to report, we did hear this item in committee.
If we
and
could have the staff report, that would be, I think, helpful for the board to hear as well.
To get context for the, any questions.
Right, so we're going to ask, Xavier, will you be handling
yes.
the response to questions? Yeah, Director of Engineering and Construction, Xavier, will provide a kind of an overview and try to respond to some of the questions or comments that have been raised by Mr. Park.
Good afternoon, President McIntosh, members
of
the board. So I do have the PowerPoint from this morning. I thought I could go through that at light speed, and then we could get to responding to some of 2019's concerns. So this is just the same presentation. To review very briefly the background, Arinda Water Treatment Plant, it's our largest and most important plant, but dating from 1933, it doesn't have all the features we would have put into a plant if it were being designed today. Specifically, it doesn't have any dedicated post-filter chlorine contact. So the consequences is that we have to rely on our aqueducts for disinfection. And it gives us very little margin for operational error, and that's the reference on the slide to CT ratio. So we've been looking for some years at long-term solutions for not just Arinda, but for all three of the inline water treatment plants to resolve disinfection byproducts, turbidity removal, a host of issues. This particular project is focused on disinfection. So in fact, its objectives are to reduce the byproducts of that disinfection. And a reminder, we did have a THM scare, near misses, last summer. So while I mentioned we were working on this project for some time, it did bring it to the forefront, and we looked at could we accelerate it. And I think where we ended up on that is we can accelerate it, but I wouldn't characterize it as a rush project. What we ended up with is a measured approach that does deal well with this issue. We want to bring a Arinda treatment plant to the same standard as our other inline water treatment plants first. For example, Walnut Creek does have the dedicated post-filtration so-called CCB, chlorine contact basin. So we're looking for a multi-barrier disinfection process. Disinfection is the single most important thing you do at a treatment plant. We do want it to be robust, reliable. So while this is something that's being done earlier than we might have originally outlined, we did take great care to make sure that the proposed project is compatible with all those long-term objectives that we were working on for the last 3 years for all the plants. So the Arinda site, as you saw from the first slide, it is very constrained. So it's like trying to do work, you know, on a ship while it's inside a bottle. And now you've heard the heart surgery metaphor. All those turn out to be true. These are examples of the sorts of excavations we might see. So they're actually alternatives for how you would build something on that constrained site. If you don't have enough space horizontally, you have to go down. So it may not be this deep, although it could be somewhere in the ballpark. We're talking about very deep excavations, and certainly that's expensive. What we anticipate is that instead of leaving this to the contractor, which would be the case for a routine project, this will be designed in some detail as the project is developed, because it has such an impact on cost and constructability. So this is something we don't do every day, and certainly the team that we have assembled in the consultant ranks has expertise in exactly this. As another example of kind of the specialized expertise, of course, we don't have UV disinfection at our other plants. It's not just that we have the actual lamps themselves and so on that have to be designed and make sure you get the right power input and contact time and so on. We also want to maintain for the long-term reliability and greenness and operational ease of a Arinda treatment plant, we want to maintain gravity as how we move water through the plant. It's a very tight plant, so that the so-called hydraulic profile doesn't have a lot of room for error. So this can be done, but it requires that we do the necessary modeling, not just of the UV system, but of the follow-on system, the chlorine contact basin. So the specialized services that we're looking for, these are some of the driving reasons. It is a UV system design. It has to be validated. So that means that we have to prove out that it's going to work. And then there's an extensive permitting process with the Department of Drinking Water. It is closely coupled, as I mentioned, so the systems have to be designed in tandem. That means that while the chlorine contact basin may be essentially a large concrete box, it does have an inlet and an outlet that have to be very carefully designed so we don't break that hydraulic profile I talked about. And then the sheer magnitude of this effort, it does represent somewhere between a third and a half of the design division's total capability. So they're looking at things like, you know, in any given year, we have dozens of projects at different stages. We have pumping plants, reservoirs, rate control stations. All that work is being designed in any given year. And you know that we're committed to sustainable infrastructure, making sure that we keep on top of that work. So even if we didn't have the expertise issue, I'd be trying to weigh, we take this one-of-a-kind project, it's very big. Do we tackle this in-house or with consultants? So they're two separable issues, expertise and capacity. Expertise is where we start, but you also have to look at capacity. Is it reasonable, even setting aside expertise, to do this in-house? And it is a one-of-a-kind project. We don't anticipate using UV at, say, our other inline treatment plants. So it would be a big impact short-term without a long-term payoff, you might say, because we wouldn't be using it on the next project. So that's some of the rationale, and this is the scope that's involved in the consulting agreements in front of you today. Corolo Engineers, it would be responsible for the actual design. So it's the UV system, as well as a couple of other systems on the plant grounds. Los Altos pumping plant is right there, and it's tangled up with the plumbing of the treatment plant, and of course its electrical system. So that ends up getting electrical upgrades. There's some needed utility relocation work within the limits of the new facilities. And then there's a CEQA process. We need to revisit the EIR from 2006 and verify that it's compatible, and if it's not, do a necessary addendum or supplement. And I mentioned the permitting already. Corolo is listed for startup and commissioning, but that is not a solo effort here. I should mention that we did institute a dedicated startup and commissioning group here at the district. It's been working out great. We're using it on complex also consultant design projects and in-house design projects. We see it as being useful for projects of all types. It doesn't replace having the consultant involved in helping start up their own work. But I would agree it's a critical aspect for that long-term maintainability and smooth startup. So we will be heavily involved in that. And CDM, they're there to provide that third-party expert review, value engineering, constructability review. And we do this sort of thing on all large projects. For example, San Pablo Dam, major treatment plant upgrades, things like that. We always do that. District forces will also be involved. Utility relocation study and design, particularly the utility relocations that aren't right in the footprint of the work that the consultant's designing. There will be chemical systems impacted. District forces will be designing that. And of course, the project management during not only design, but also construction. Our own forces then will be managing the contractor. And I talked about the startup and commissioning group that we have, which is kind of a blend of design and construction staff. And they will be, of course, assigned to this project. I anticipate heavy involvement. Document review. What's meant there is actual review of all of the many deliverables that will be produced during this major effort. And then the final reference is actually depicted here in the picture. We need to do some pilot testing to support the design, and district staff will be leading that pilot to figure out how we can, in fact, address that future maintainability that I think people are rightly concerned about. When you put in a new technology, you have to make sure you can support it for the long term, that it will be maintainable. So we completely agree that's important, and we're leading the study that will inform that future maintenance activity. So the next steps, this afternoon you have in front of you the consulting agreements for your consideration. And the district staff in the meantime will be completing a series of investigations, surveying utility locations, things like potholing. And we won't do all of the geotechnical investigations ourselves, but that will be supported by things like boring. We don't do our own borings, but you take soil samples and then interpret them. And so the next step here is we would, with those two things underway, that would support going into detailed design. We anticipate that'll take well over 2 years, about 2.5 years to do detailed design. So that's the presentation, but I could offer some comments that are responsive to Local 2019's concerns.
Please.
First, I just wanted to say kind of the overall context here. I've been the director of engineering for well over 10 years, and I've been in engineering for longer than that. We don't just jump straight to consultant design. We design dozens of projects per year, and consultant design is the exception. So we don't just go there first. We don't go there lightly. The vast majority of our work continues to be designed in-house. And in fact, we do have a habit of growing staff and staff capabilities, whichever or both of those it takes to deliver projects when I believe, on balance, that it's the right thing for us to do. So we have done that, as you may recall, for various projects. I'm not shy about proposing we should have additional staff. And so we have brought staff on, say, for the Orinda treatment plant work, for the McKelmy intertie work, for the polybutylene lateral project, for Folsom South Canal, which, by the way, was a huge project designed in-house. So I think when the facts support it, I'm right there saying, let's grow staff. We can do this job. I have tremendous regard for our in-house capabilities, not just to do stuff that we already know how to do, but, you know, to grow the envelope a little bit. But again, we're weighing that. Does it make sense? Is there continued work there? Or is this really a niche for us, a one-off project? So I'm classifying this project really it is that one-off project. It's not one where I see that on balance we should be or even could be reasonably tackling it in-house. You look at the sheer challenges of, you know, it wouldn't be just providing the manpower. It'd be literally trying to hire expertise. That's very difficult to come by. You're looking for how many people have actually personally worked on the design of, we don't really want this to be their first or their second UV facility. This is our flagship treatment plant. So we want someone who's done it a lot. If you're going in for your eye surgery, you really don't want someone who just has done it once. So that's what we're looking for, and it's very difficult to hire, particularly if we were looking at hiring LTs with that kind of capability. I see that as essentially infeasible. There is also, I think there's been a proposal, what about fragmenting the project, you know, chopping off pieces that are more approachable? I think that when you take a project that is this tightly stacked, it wouldn't be like other projects that have lent themselves better to blending. For example, I was the head of the Walnut Creek Treatment Plant Improvements in the year 2000, and we looked at that pretty hard. It was huge, so we couldn't do it all, but we said, well, yeah, we can do this chunk and we can do that chunk, and it worked. But they were geographically separate. We tackled stuff that maybe we didn't know how to do everything, but it was within a reasonable envelope of, yeah, we do want to learn this. We can learn it, and it's so we'll do the necessary kind of let's grow our staff capabilities. We'll use it on other projects, which turned out to be true. So those factors aren't in play here for this project. So I certainly have great respect for 2019's careful consideration of this. They and the project team have been talking about this for well over 6 months now. And so I think everyone has put their best thinking on, you know, how could this possibly be done different ways. So I think we end up, it really boils down to, in my judgment, how could we deliver this very important project? And respecting the different viewpoints, I probably end up coming down a little bit differently than 2019 and some of those judgments. It's easy to think of the concrete box concept for the chlorine contact basin. I think that might be oversimplifying it. It'd be like calling, you know, the Great Egyptian Pyramid just a pile of rocks. There's a lot more to it than that. To get, while it may be as simple as moving rocks around into place, it actually does have to be carefully designed. The detailing is going to matter. The inlet and outlet to the chlorine contact basin, its impact on the hydraulic profile, all the consideration of what happens during operational upsets, that all has to be really designed with one common design voice, one point of accountability. So that's why I think that really we need a cohesive team. That would avoid what I would call the Frankenstein, to borrow a term. I think you really do want one clear vision for the design rather than seeking to fragment it.
Zoff, I was waiting for you to get to the point, and I think you were about to get on
okay.
the point. The key thing that I didn't quite understand this morning, and I'm still not sure I do now, is why the chlorine contact tank has to be so integrated with the UV, because I think that's the point of contention here.
Well, in space, they're right next to each other. So you're talking probably about one excavation that is really, it's designed as one. And then you have water that flows from one into the other, and you need to be able to bypass the chlorine contact basin if needed, and or for that matter, turn off the UV and let water. So you need to account for all the operational modes of these two systems that are physically right next to each other. So they would be designed with a lot of the same, say the shoring that I showed you, where you have those very deep excavations. That may well be one excavation that is for both of them. So the idea that, well, one entity, district staff, would go off and design their part and the consultant would design their part, I think...
Well, they wouldn't have to necessarily go off. I mean, they would talk to each other and they would... But you used the term one voice, and I thought that was an interesting term. They should be designed with one voice.
Well, what you want is you want design responsibility, you know, accountability. So when... there really has to be one engineer in responsible charge of any given element of the work.
So when problems arise, they say, oh, it was their fault.
Exactly. Right. So the idea of having a cohesive team and really one a very simple kind of accountability for who is in responsible charge of this work. I think the project I mentioned where it worked better, I thought, to have district staff doing discrete elements. At Walnut Creek, we had discrete facilities around a very large campus, and we could say, okay, the district staff is doing this particular component. So we certainly do, we feel very comfortable. We have very qualified staff to jump in and do treatment plant design work. They'll be doing, for example, chemical systems. It's just, I think I need to set them up for success and not say, you know, congratulations, you've got a piece of a project that you've never done. And we don't really know, we don't have clear lines of accountability. I think that would be not setting them up for success.
I think I heard in your presentation both this morning and this afternoon that it's not like the consultant is going to be operating without any oversight from staff.
I was going to mention that it's not just the project management part, but during design, over that 2.5-year period, there are design workshops which are envisioned to have district staff involved every step of the way. So starting at things like conceptual design, so that we don't just get the keys thrown at us when it's done, or here it is, and try to operate this thing. We'll have been part of significant decisions along the way, significant trade-offs. You know, we can do A or B, and we'll be right there with the core design team making some of those trade-offs. You know, we have these different choices, and they might have impacts on operations and maintenance and essentially the future of the facility. So we'll have our engineers as well as our operations and maintenance staff involved in those workshops every step of the way.
Hang on, John. There was a full presentation before the planning committee this morning, correct?
Yes.
What,
yes.
Did that result in a recommendation from the planning committee?
To bring it to the board.
There was a two-piecer. One is, yes, we approve, but we also felt that we wanted the full board to hear this discussion. So you can call it a contingency approval, if you will.
So you did approve.
We did approve, but we wanted the full board to hear it to make a determination.
No, I get that. Right, that's why we're here right now, but I wanted to hear the word approve.
I mean, no, the word approve would not be appropriate for that, because what, Frank, you actually said, because you were the one who made the motion, was to move this on to the full board.
All right, so there was no vote other than to move it here. Okay, yes. Thank you for that clarification. Okay. John.
Sure. Zav, can you, I know that this was not in our budget, the $8 million to do this work, and it mentions that in the BD1. So staff who are going to be working on other projects as a result of this, you have sufficient funds, quote unquote, elsewhere to do the $8 million contract. So would there be a problem? Is there a problem if staff, as Jay talked about, were to get involved with this, or is it better to keep them working on the other projects to keep them in queue and on time and on schedule?
I would say I want both of those. I want all those other projects to go ahead, keep them on time and on schedule. But I mentioned the deep involvement that our staff will have, as outlined now. So our objective is to do both of those things. That doesn't mean handing design responsibility to district staff for this project, though.
Okay, I guess it was embedded in the BD1, and the way I read it is the $8 million and that work that you're asking us to approve is going to be with Carollo and CDM Smith as oversight, and that will allow then our staff to continue on the other projects, which will not get deferred as a result, since this was not in our planning schedule.
That's right. They will be able to continue developing that other work. I think that, you know, as you know, we're coming up on budget season, and we'll take another look at the timing of all of these projects. Recall, though, that we ended up with a relatively measured pace for this work at Arinda. So it'll take place over the next 5 years. So we have time to true up the budget, to look at what other elements, for example, other treatment plant work, could be deferred or downsized or would be made unnecessary by this project. Yes, Director Yeh?
Thanks, Bob. This morning you indicated that the work contained in the consultant agreements would be the equivalent of like 18 FTE, which is this morning
yes.
You said it was a half, but sorry, you said it was half. I think you said a third to a half, but in any case, significant number of our facilities design team.
Right, I think I estimated about a third to a half.
And then for the work that is contemplated to be done by district forces, what FTE equivalent is that? You guys figured that out?
We might have a number for it. Otherwise, I'll provide a guesstimate. Yeah. Well, I'm getting an estimate of roughly four, but I think it's bigger than that when you add things like surveying that are not part of the design division, but they are required to do all the steps that I outlined during the design phase.
Okay.
And there'll also be significant O&M involvement, too, to assure that it's something we can maintain in the future. So,
Mr. General Manager, do you believe, number one, is this time sensitive? What happens if it's not approved today?
If it's not time sensitive to the point where the world will stop spinning if it doesn't go today.
Okay. That's sufficient for me. So
the
next question, Mr. General Manager, if we put this over and allow staff to have more conversation with labor, do you think that would be fruitful and productive?
Well, normally I'm all for additional conversation, but as Xavier mentioned, we've had quite a bit of opportunity to converse over the last, 4 to 6 months, And so I'm not sure that there was a meeting even last Thursday that there's going to be a significant change in perspective. That said, I think, you know, based on a conversation I just had with Xavier earlier this morning, we can assure the board that we're going to make every effort to create learning opportunities for staff so that we can continue to grow the expertise in areas which we'll find useful in years to come. And so that'll be the 4+ or maybe more if you add the O&M FTEs that would be involved in this. So with that, you know, if you and I sense further discussion, but I'd recommend that we take action to just advance the project. It's something that when you consider the what we experienced with the high THMs in the distribution system, we had considered a very accelerated approach, and we were going to try to do this in 3 years. We have I counseled that we should take more time to make sure we don't trip over ourselves and make mistakes. So now we're talking about 5 years, but it's still on a timeline that we'd like to avoid having further upsets if we have another drought and the water quality changes in the source water.
Andy.
Yes. So I heard noted that there was a interest in having a staff collaboration and to have a learning opportunity on this. Have those details been worked out? What level of detail is arranged or contemplated there? Did that happen in a meet and confer process, or is it just an idea that you think you would be able to aspire to?
Well, we haven't had the so-called meet and confer. That has a kind of a legal overtone to it. We have discussed it, as the general manager mentioned. We've discussed the contract and its scope and so on, and our approach. I think at something in the neighborhood of half a dozen meetings and so on. I would say that the degree of district involvement has been very well thought out. So if you look at the way that we interact with our consultant, it's not really an atypical approach that we are deeply embedded. For, as I mentioned, things like design workshops that we would have district staff engaged from the very beginning of the project all the way through project delivery. Our involvement would actually increase thanks to the startup and commissioning group I talked about. And we started that as kind of a trial. Let's see how well it works. That's been working really well. So I expect we might be, as we look at staffing over the next few years, we might try to actually grow that group a little bit. But the responsibility is on this project, where we have checkpoints with the consultant. That is actually laid out in quite a bit of detail. They can't just start design and then come back when they're done. It's a very interactive process. And that is by design to meet two objectives. One, make sure the project's right. And two, make sure that we do understand this facility, that we can maximize our learning opportunities for staff, and then staff can be there to help support it in the long term. So I would say, in short, yes to your question. We've thought about that quite a bit.
All right. What's the pleasure of the group? Do we have a motion?
I'll move the item, both 3-1 and 3-2.
I will second.
Andy?
So I'm inclined to allow for a little bit more time to move. I think what I would hear is past the learning opportunities, but to actually understand what the work plan would be for staff involvement. So I clearly we're going to need some help to do something that we haven't done before to install UV treatment at this facility. But I did hear, I think, enough of a difference of opinion between Local 2019 and what I think we could accomplish with a little bit more time. So that's my perspective. I'd like to vote on this at our next meeting.
All right, Doug.
So I got the opportunity to listen to this morning and think about it some, and now here I'm prepared to vote for this. I hear loud and clear the concerns from 2019, our engineers here, and I wish we could accommodate them in total on this, but I see several things. One, an effort has been made, I'm convinced at least, that there's been several meetings, and if you said, Zov, opportunities to kind of look at this in different ways and how to make it work, but that there's just kind of ended up with an agreement to disagree if you will. So I don't know that an additional meeting would be that helpful. Secondly, I think that the schedule does seem to be this kind of came out of I wouldn't say out of nowhere, but certainly came upon us fairly quickly. Our ability to have the right staffing or a large enough staff to be able to deal with this and all the other projects adds an extra monkey wrench in the whole ability to try and work something out on this. And then finally, I think I am concerned as well about the timeliness of keeping this project moving forward. It does go to the heart of our ability to supply safe drinking water to our customers. And so that's important. So I'm ready to vote for it. I do encourage, and I will be watching and listening for some sort of progress to be made on how to integrate our staff as much as possible under the circumstances to get the experience that can be gotten from observing and reviewing and overseeing the project as it goes forward. I know it's not the same, and I certainly heard, I think Jay made a very good presentation this morning and this afternoon, a very good case, but I think this is one where there just isn't a good, easy answer on that.
Okay, Bill, then Marguerite.
I'm inclined to agree, particularly hearing the committee and where they're coming from, because they dealt with this more in detail. I think past practices would say we would work with our staff to the degree possible so that there's learning opportunity and interchange of information. Historically, that's been where the district has been on many projects, including the Folsom South Canal connectivity when we were doing that project. And many others, as I can recount, where we've had that opportunity. The key is that our staff be most familiar with any new practices or procedures and how to understand and maintain what we're going to get. They have to operate it and maintain it. So that's the key for me, and I would tend to support the position.
So folks recall, I mean, this getting moved to where it is because we came very close to violating probably the most important, one of the most important drinking water rules that we have around disinfection byproducts, created quite a stir, in the community. And we are right now juggling operational procedures to help us maintain that, and we're looking at, we may be looking at another dry year coming. We may be, over the course of this next 5 years, it's very likely that we will be challenged again by that until this is online. So I think it's very important to move forward with it. And I've been convinced by what I've read and what I understand in, reading and learning about UV is that this, because in large part because of the site constraints around gravity, around the close interaction between the contact basin and the UV design, depth of excavation, et cetera, that this is something that you want to have cohesion around. So I don't see it as being, yes, we put concrete boxes in the ground, all the time. So I think there is quite an opportunity for, and I echo Doug and Frank this morning said, sort of a sidecar approach that we make sure that our district forces are being maximally deployed to assure and ensure that we're able to reliably operate this as we go forward. I'm hearing that that's built in, and I like Doug will be watching that, but I think we need to move forward with this. So I'll be voting in support of the motion.
All right. If there's nothing further, it's an important project, but I think just before we vote, you hear from a majority of the board, there's a clear message that we'd like to see our staff integrated into this project as much as possible.
I heard that loud and clear.
With that, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right. Thanks, Av. That moves us to determination and discussion. Item 5, to consider a resolution to appoint the following individuals as standby officers for the East Bay MUD Board of Directors as outlined in the Director's Emergency Succession Plan, which was adopted on May 23rd, 2017. I'm going to name names. So be prepared, and if you are present, please stand when your name is called. For Ward 1, Cecilia McCoy, Linda Jackson Whitmore, Linnell Lewis. Yay, Team Lisa. Ward 2, Dennis Deemer, Carol Rowley, and Robert Dean.
Go Team 2.
Ward 3, Jennifer Jackson, Peter Vorster, and Randy Canals.
Go Team 3.
Ward 4, Helen Burke. Ward 5, Heinrich Albert and James Frola.
Thank you, Team 5.
Ward 6, Robert Harris and Jose Guzman. And last but not least, Ward 7, Calvin Sakamoto, Gene Ashford Jr., and Gregory Chan.
A fine group of people.
You can take your seat. I'll read a brief statement. So on behalf of the Board of Directors, I would like to welcome and thank each of you for being willing to step up to this important role. I see that we have former East Bay MUD employees, a former East Bay MUD general manager, a former board member, and our constituents ready to come on board in the event of an emergency. And again, thank you from all of us. We encourage you to learn all that you can about the district. We are an agency rich in history and are tasked with providing a most vital resource to our customers, water. Our website and social media platforms are a good place to start. To keep you abreast of actions taken by the board, you will begin receiving emailed agendas and notices, as well as notices when significant district projects or topics are being scheduled, discussed, or completed. We will now receive a brief presentation from staff regarding the functionality of the board's emergency succession plan. And again, thank you.
Indeed, thank you.
Well, good afternoon, President McIntosh and members of the board and soon-to-be standby officers under the succession plan. I just want to, this afternoon, give a brief presentation, an overview of the implementation of the succession plan in the event of an emergency. And over the next six slides or so, I'm going to be reviewing the key definitions under the succession plan, the process by which we determine the unavailability of regular officers and seating standby officers, the ongoing duties of standby officers until they're seated, and the term of service of standby officers. And I'll take any questions. So just to remind the board succession plan would only apply in three types of emergencies defined under the California Emergency Services Act: a state of war emergency, which is an undeclared emergency that happens automatically in the event of an attack on the United States of America; a state of emergency, which is an emergency declared by the governor of California and only by the governor of California; or a local emergency, which is an emergency declared by a city, a county, or a city and county. Now, the district has the power to declare emergencies under the MUD Act, but that applies to district emergencies and is only relevant to the suspension of our low bid requirements for contracting. The district does not have the power to declare emergency for the purposes of the succession plan. There are two key terms under the succession plan and CISA that apply to our plan, and that is unavailable. The first plan term is unavailable. Well, I'm sorry, the first one was emergency, which I've covered. So the second term is unavailable, and that means under CISA, either killed, missing, or so seriously injured as to be unable to attend meetings or otherwise perform duties. Now, there were some questions in the past from board members regarding the application of the term unavailable under our plan, and so in our succession plan, we've clarified that the unavailability must be the result of the emergency itself. And we have also allowed board members to declare themselves to be unavailable following an emergency.
Can I ask one question? I know we've covered this before, but just to have clarity, unavailable means in person or by phone, or are we talking just about in person?
That is a good question. I believe really unavailable means unavailable to serve as a board member. So in theory, it's killed, injured. Just to go back to the slide, it's killed, missing, or so seriously injured as to be unable to attend meetings.
Any of the alternatives you don't want. That's
yeah.
what it is.
Right.
But as long as, you know, I can still hold the phone to my ear.
Yeah.
I have cognitive abilities to serve.
Well,
and
you could
you're
miss,
alive and not missing.
Right. Yeah, you could miss a meeting, right, be absent from a meeting and that sort of, but still be able to serve. You're just
right.
temporarily unavailable. Just different than, obviously, killed, injured.
Right. I believe if you can teleconference in, then you're not missing, you're not so seriously injured, and you're not killed. So.
Well, and that leads us to the next slide, which is the determination of the unavailability of a board member. Once an emergency is declared under CISA, the general manager is going to determine the availability of regular officers by contacting you via the means that you've left under the
Derek,
the
I have
manager.
A question on this. Mm-hmm. God forbid it ever has to be declared, but assuming it's in the first category, let's say, of war or attack, what happens if the general manager is also unavailable, as is the board majority? Where does it then, where does it fall within the hierarchy of staff in the event Alex or whomever are not available to participate to make that available, to determine the availability of regular officers?
Well, would you like to take
I would just share with the board that our emergency operations team has a succession plan identified as a part of it for all key positions, including general manager and general counsel.
So I'm assuming that means, again, if we're talking war, hopefully not, is there somebody that you have and Craig have designated outside of our service area that are able then to step in the event of that happening?
No, the way we're structured, because we're rather deep here in the with 2,000 employees, is to draw from within the organization to serve as general manager and general counsel. We don't have alternates such as you're identifying here that are outside of the service area.
Yeah, I thank you. I know we have the back room and all that, but, you know, you read the newspaper, you watch what's happening in the world, and it's like, okay, this is a little bit more reality than we thought when I proposed this 2 years ago. So I whatever, you may want to still, I think maybe our advice is to have somebody outside the service area who's an employee be designated just in case.
That's a good suggestion. We'll take a look. I believe we do have employees outside the service area on the emergency operations team. So,
yeah.
So, Alex, perhaps maybe a memo as to that for the full board?
Yes, give us a little time. It's a perspective that we want to think through.
Sure.
So the general manager or his successor will determine the availability of each of you.
Nice.
And under CISA, you're required to convene as soon as possible after an emergency so that you can get down to the business of responding to the emergency. The general manager will request a standby officer to attend the meeting for each regular officer unavailable to attend. The standby officers will be contacted in their order of their designation, 1, 2, or 3, and the first available standby officer will be the one that attends the first meeting in your place. And then the general manager will formally report to the board as a body at the first meeting the availability of each regular officer not present at the meeting. And at that point, you would make a determination as to how you're going to fill the seats of unavailable regular officers. If five regular officers are available, you have a choice under either the MUD Act or CISA. And five is the key number because it requires five board members to declare a district emergency for the suspension of the low bid contracting requirements. So if five regular officers are available, you may fill the unavailable positions under the MUD Act within 60 days through an appointment, or you may have the standby officers immediately begin serving to fill the unavailable officer's place under CISA. Now, if five regular officers are unavailable, you need to fill that slot. And so under the plan, standby officers will immediately serve in the place of all unavailable regular officers. Now, from today going forward, after the appointment today, standby officers will be taking the oath of office. They will be required to complete a Form 700 this year, and that is the conflict of interest reporting that public officers are required to fill out under the Fair Political Practices Act. This requirement is based on some advice we received from the Fair Political Practices Committee. This is a new issue for the committee. They've never dealt with emergency standby officers under CISA before. So we're going to be working with the Fair Political Practices Committee over the next year to try and come up with a different answer so as to lessen the administrative burden both on staff and our standby officers.
So by this year, that means by the end of this year? Is that
by the
that
end
means?
Of this year. Okay. Because the plan requires you to reaffirm their appointment every year. So we are going to be a year from now trying to have that reaffirmation take place in a manner that doesn't require the annual filling out of a Form 700. Standby officers must remain informed of board member duties and district affairs, and President McIntosh has explained a bit how you would be emailed copies of board documents and links to board documents and agendas. And as to district affairs, my understanding is that the Office of the Secretary will also be providing each of you with a binder with a whole packet of materials on the governance of East Bay MUD. Many of you are somewhat familiar with it, having been former employees, so this will be some catch-up. And you must remain, standby officers must remain ready to report for duty following an emergency. Does this mean no vacations for standby officers? No, it simply means that while you can visit Parrish, you can't move there. And you should also be physically and mentally able to serve, so.
I just heard somebody say, thank you, Frank.
And as I mentioned earlier, the list of standby officers will be reviewed annually by the Office of the Secretary, and the appointment will be reaffirmed by this board. And upon filling the place of a regular officer, each standby officer will have all the powers and duties of a regular officer, and the service of a standby office continues until the regular office becomes available. The dismissal of the standby officer, or the election or appointment of a new regular office in accordance with the MUD Act. So that is the implementation of the plan in a nutshell, and I'll take any further questions.
Derek, thank you. I mean, when I brought this forward 2 years ago, people looked at me like, what the hell are you talking about, John? And actually, it was the city of San Ramon I read about in the paper had this, and it made a lot of sense. And so there's a lot of work by the general counsel's office and your efforts, and hopefully it never has to be initiated.
Yeah.
But in the event it is, I think we have all identified very capable people who could fill in, take care of the business of the day. And with that, I'll move the item.
Second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. If there's nothing further, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right. Congratulations.
Thank you, everyone.
Now you will be led out of the chambers to be sworn in.
And if you don't take the oath, they're going to handcuff you and make sure you do it until you say yes.
And if you do take the oath, you get to have cookies with us afterwards, I think.
Yes,
idea.
We should be joining you as soon as we wind up this meeting.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Randy.
Thank you.
Actually, you get handcuffed to a water pipe, but that's something else.
They do that in rivers.
I tried to.
All right, so board willing, we could proceed with a water supply update.
All right.
Well, we have your artillery going out there.
Okay.
Good afternoon, President McIntosh.
Good afternoon.
Members of the board. It has not been a very eventful 3 weeks of weather, but nonetheless, staff have been busy compiling all sorts of information to bring you the latest information. Keep you apprised of everything. We'll begin with the water production. This year is shown in black. We're still about 10% above last year. Take note to the last 3 weeks where you can see a pretty significant departure of water production, as the last 2 weeks in January were very warm and dry, as well as the first week, notwithstanding the last couple days, which was quite cold. Also shown on this chart is, which hopefully is visible in green there, above immediately above the black line, that is the water production from 2013, which was the state board's baseline year for water reduction and conservation. So you can see that we've been creeping back up for the last couple years. We're within about 10% of 2013 at this point. Looking upcountry at the precipitation, we've received in the McKelmey watershed. When I first saw this, I thought Sean was joking with me, but in fact, we have had zero precipitation the first 10 days or so of February. We had zero precipitation the last couple weeks of January. But January did finish up about 75% of average, but we are still struggling. And I should also mention that the next 2 weeks, the next 10 or 14 days, yeah, it does not look like much. To the extent we have confidence in the forecast beyond 14 days, we can't really give much credence to that. But the next 10 or 14 days, there's nothing significant coming. So February is probably going to end up pretty close to December when we're all said and done in terms of total precip upcountry. Locally as well, similar story. We almost got to normal for January locally, but similar figures here. February will look a lot like December when February is done. Cumulative for the year, or sorry, for the season to date average, we're at 53% locally. Upcountry, just under 70%, which still surprises me considering how dry it's been and how dry it feels. November is why we're even close to 70% at this point, because November was quite wet. But we're still, all being said, we're still 70%, which is not too bad. Different story for the snowpack. Looking at 8,000 feet at Capels Lake. After the last board meeting, we got a foot of snow at Capels. Late January, that is more or less melted at this point. We picked up a foot in late January. That's more or less melted at this point. We are tracking water year 2015 in terms of snowpack, which was the driest of the dry years in the recent drought. So not a good snowpack up country. Quantitatively, 18% of snow depth for season to date, and water content just 23%. Looking statewide, throughout the Sierra Nevada, northern, central, and southern Sierra, pretty consistent snowpack. The two numbers shown there, one is percent for the entire year. That's the number that you see in the teens, the mid-teens there throughout the Sierra. The second number is the average water snow equivalent for the season to date, which is a little higher in the mid-20s. So no one has much of a snowpack anywhere. Looking at this visually, on the left, you'll see the snowpack a year ago, and those colors denote about, I know it's hard to read that chart there, that scale, but we had a quite expansive snowpack a year ago geographically, and most of the Sierra Nevada was showing 6 or 7 feet of snow, of water equivalent. Snow depth, of course, was much deeper than that. This year, we're showing a water equivalent from the snow in the inches, 5 to 6 inches, and geographically a much more confined and contained snowpack. So not a lot up there right now. Surprisingly, statewide storage is actually pretty good. Again, just like the district storage, the snowpack last year is where we are right now. Most of the reservoirs throughout the state are doing pretty well. They're above average for year to date. The glaring exception is Oroville. Oroville is still operating under interim operating rules right now because they're still actively trying to repair the spillway. I talked to state water contractors yesterday. They're expecting a 20% allocation. The state will probably stay at that 20% allocation as long as it remains dry. And if Oroville were under normal operating rules and were a higher elevation in storage, that number would probably be 35 to 40%. So you can see that the Oroville spillway issue is affecting the state in any number of ways. The CVP, municipal and industrial customers, contractors, are expecting 75% allocation from the Bureau once they make that public in a week or so. Our storage remains very good. It's been above 620,000 acre feet for...
I would just insert that that's for M&I, not necessarily for ag or south of Delta.
Right. Our storage has been above 620,000 acre feet for months now. The only storage we have available is our flood reserve capacity. So our storage remains very good. So the bottom line, and in summary, we see that this chart is showing projected forecasted runoff as well as total system storage by the end of the year with three hydrologies. If March and April turn wet, and again, we can see most of February at this point, so it's coming down to March and April. If March and April are wet, above average, we can still, for the most part, fill our system storage. If we have a median hydrology for those last 2 months of the water year, we'll be at 570,000 acre feet. And if it remains dry, we will be down as low as 500,000 acre feet. So we still don't see the need to pursue any supplemental water at this point. We will obviously be back in 2 weeks. At that point, we'll have a sneak peek of at least the first half of March when we look at the extended forecast. So it's not too late, and we'll be back with more information shortly.
Thank you. Bill, did you have?
No, I was just listening to the report, and part of the reason my hand went up, I don't want to delay getting over to congratulate our successor, but the interesting thing was a session I attended in Sacramento, and everybody up there at the state conference for this is Black Chamber of Commerce, and kind of tied into, and this is my take, looking at people who are opportunists, trying to get into the act primarily to gravitate some support for the state project or some employment opportunities to get involved in the mainstream. I think what I've been critical on is the example of the state in terms of its maintenance and operations. You know, the dam section authorities compel us to do things. We don't have a choice, and we don't have a delaying tactic. Orville stands out as a major piece where they didn't maintain it properly, and now they're paying on the other side. And so I just raise these things to say climate change has put us in a different ballgame, and if our facilities aren't equipped to handle the pressure of those, we're in bad shape. And so the state hadn't done a good job, even though it has monies available and the proper one and other things to help itself. I always want to make sure as we review these things, we keep in mind that we're in another era. Climate change has taken us to a different place. And so as we have to be vigilant on this end, somehow we have to get those who are higher up than us in their website and in their gun sight to do diligence on projects and get things done. Otherwise, the collapse that comes from the top affects everything downline. And Orville has affected a whole bunch of people in terms of their homes and living conditions and everything else, but also the water supply that should be captured in Orville that isn't there. You see, these are the impacts that I guess I pay attention to the detail more than others as I look at the global picture of California. And so we have to always be in the mix for being advocates of moving things along. One of the senators I know when we visited up there was all concerned about what we were going to do in terms of the salaries for our employees and, you know, looking at us with a jaundiced eye. And I'm saying the state didn't do well by employees during the tough times. And so they got a lot of making up to do. They didn't do well by projects during the tough times. We did well by the employees and the projects. And so I just want to make sure that people know that East Bay Mud is on top of his game and that the state isn't necessarily. And there's something that's got to happen between us down here on the ground who are doing a good job and the state understanding. It's waving a lot of flags, but in its cadre of responsibility, isn't doing a very good job. And so they need to be reminded somehow. And I see the press is doing some of that now. There are a lot of articles coming out where they're being looked at. And so I want to thank you for keeping us updated and making sure the board understands that it has a staff that's very vigilant. And we get the triggers on what to do when, and sometimes better than any other district I know of. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. So on to social media update. I do, Mark, would you like to speak before or after?
Can I defer and not speak?
Sure. We won't be mad at you.
You feeling okay with Mark?
Yeah, I'm doing okay.
So we had scheduled to have a presentation during our planning committee this morning. We spent a little more time than we expected on another item, so Allison's going to give us a quick run-through, and I think the whole board will appreciate where we're headed.
Yep. Good afternoon, McIntosh, fellow directors. Thank you so much for this time. This is a brief update on social media for the district. Just a reminder why we, of course, do social media. We spend our time on social media platforms. You can see Twitter. I'll talk about Facebook in a moment, but LinkedIn and Nextdoor as a mechanism to do customer engagement. You'll see in a moment sort of this is the face of East Bay Mud and how we capture attention and allow people to understand what we're doing when they may not know something about us. We also use it as an emergency prep and response tool. So social media is a very fast mechanism and very low-cost mechanism to reach large numbers of people. It's also about brand reputation, so that if there is something being said about East Bay Mud, we have the opportunity to put our message out there directly to individuals so they can read what we're trying to get across. And we have the ability to get analytics very quickly from all of these platforms. One thing I will add, it was in your memo that when we did our customer survey of those in our service area, so that was customers and non-billing, bill-paying customers, 52% did identify that social media platforms are one way they're getting information. So that's a significant touch point we really want to be touching, getting our information out through. So as I mentioned, if you follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn, we do cross-reference these stories. It's a great visual diary. We, again, try and promote a variety of activities and items that we're working on, from water supply and issues that come up to construction projects and things that you may not know about East Bay Mud and the work we do. We are also able to, again, as I mentioned, manage the message. So when we have things that come up, we are able to put out information immediately that is our message that's unadulterated by whatever media or wherever else may be.
You mean it's not fake news?
We try to keep it not fake news, our own truth. So we typically put out anything that we put out to the press or as an advisory, we will post as well on social media. Some of the highlights from 2017, you can see we are on Twitter. We've been on for a while. We're just over 2,000 followers. That's 30% up over the prior year. This has been a natural accumulation. We have not done any sort of paid advertising. You'll hear me talk in a moment about our plan to increase that. We do have an increase clicks through to East Bay Mud of 92% and likes. So again, that's just, we have sort of two steps in the process of social media, which is just people seeing our content, whether they actually click through to East Bay Mud to find more information or not. It's a good face on the organization. As you can see, the top tweet that we had in 2017 was this time-lapse video of Summit Reservoir Concrete Pour, which had 1,100 views and 6,600 impressions, so people seeing it in their feeds. So people are seeing this content, and some are selecting to click on it and actually view it. The content is mostly about the diversity of our work and our 24-hour operations. We put in customer pipeline articles, splashes articles on the job profiles, events, emerging issues. We do have a plan to increase this in the coming year. We are looking at doing some ads, both on Twitter and, as I will talk about, Facebook in a moment. They're very low cost, so they enable us to really target towards an audience and get more followers so we have a larger reach.
Allison,
yes.
Before you move to I'm not a tweeter.
Yes. That's okay.
Explain to me, really, the difference between views and impressions.
So impressions are typically when it's showing up in a feed versus a view where you're clicking on it to look at it.
Oh, okay.
Right? So sometimes
a view is specific.
Right. You're taking an action to look at it closer versus it's just showing up in a string and you may pass by it. But you still get a quick look at it. And this is what's great about Twitter in particular, is short message, quick view. It's showing up.
Are we getting many shares?
We do get, you know, I don't have all the statistics I could follow up, but we do get a fair amount of some likes, you know, and so, and again, I think we definitely see this with media. Media picks up some of these stories when we put our information out. So Berkeley Side has reposted, the mayor of Berkeley, I know in particular.
Now that we don't have a reporter from ANG News anymore covering water issues, that's probably how they're going to start reporting it, is what is put on here.
Right. So it is important for us to have our own ability to directly put that message out. I know. You're very sad to hear that. On the job, so this is one of the features we've put both on Twitter and LinkedIn, and it is on the website. We've been sharing those as well weekly. These are profiles of district staff. We did 45 profiles last year. We're continuing them this year. Produced 2,500 unique page views to the website. So when you look at it on Twitter, it's a very short little image. You have to click through to get their full story. We put those in splashes as well. I think they've been a really fantastic way.
I retweet that each week. I get it.
Thank you. Yes, I think Doug does too. I've seen. So they're great snapshots for people to see who it is that does a variety of work here at the district. And we try and be very conscious of reaching at all depths and heights of the organization, so that we're showing the full spectrum, both for job, you know, if you want to apply, and or just to recognize what it takes to do the work we do. So Nextdoor, we've been using that over the last year. So this is a very large platform, 286,000 people who are on the platform in our service area. We've done 45 posts. A lot of those are focused on construction updates, but we have put things out about emerging issues. We do put our customer pipeline article, our summary out there, and a link through to our website so that those customers who are not bill paying customers can have access to those same articles and information about us. We did get, you know, we do accumulate thanks, 1,200 thanks over that time frame, and this is just an acknowledgement. We do keep comments closed on Nextdoor because we want to direct them to reach out to us either by email or phone on the specific issue. And that top post there was the John Muir Land Trust and East Bay Mud Partnership on Carr Ranch, 450 thanks when we put that out in, I believe, March of last year. So we are on LinkedIn. This one also has 3,800 followers, 233,000 impressions per year. So we really like LinkedIn. LinkedIn likes us. We think this is also people looking for jobs here at the district. So it's a really another great place for us to put on the job profiles, all of the career postings, and places when we're on going to career fairs are posted on LinkedIn as well. Facebook. So here's our next step forward. Facebook. We're basically proposing that we step into Facebook in March of 2018. Our goal is to get about 800 followers in this year, so that's a natural attrition. We'll be looking at doing some ads, assuming we have budget and it's low cost. Again, we're trying to coordinate all of our content. We won't be posting every day at the start for Facebook, but a couple of times a week, probably our on-the-job profiles and any other items of interest, so that we can build enough content that is matching our other strings of content, so we're not creating different strings. We're basically repeating the same content on different channels. We do have increased monitoring expectations because Facebook is an exchange back and forth. And so I do have another slide on this, just to talk about how we manage on Twitter right now and how we expect to manage on Facebook, that we do try to affirm positive comments about East Bay Mud. And if they're negative, we try and monitor them, correct facts, or fix them. We have to make choices whether we engage or not. That's something we deal with right now on Twitter. Most of the time we have some good exchanges where somebody will say something, we're able to at least redirect and confirm that they've reached us, and then they feel like they've gotten a good contact. So just next steps, I wanted to mention, when we go into Facebook, we are expecting to set an automatic response in non-business hours that enables people, reminds them to contact our contact center. That's the venue we want people to be calling for main breaks and other issues. We're hoping to grow Twitter up to 3,000 followers, launch Facebook in March of 2018, invest in those social media ads on Twitter and Facebook. Again, low cost, targeted demographics so that we can gain followers and spread the message. Increasing our engagement and just continuing to measure growth. And I believe that's the summary of the presentation. So, any questions?
Okay, let's start at the end and work our way back.
I'm really glad to see the progress that we're making in this area. And I could give you a couple other platforms of, like, Snapchat. When are we going to get on Instagram?
Yeah.
When we'll still be sort of, I don't know that ever in Snapchat, but. I think we've done this, so just affirm that when we have events like our water conservation workshops or we're participating in, you know, different events that we'll be posting those. I mean, yes. Facebook is a really good platform for that, mm-hmm. I think, in terms of events. So just we do that already, have done that.
Correct, yes.
Okay.
And if there's something we're participating in that's another organization where we have a table, we will retweet frequently. So, yes, we use it for any of the events and career fairs and other items.
Right. And then as we get on Facebook, we'll be just like on Twitter, I'm assuming. We follow, you know, there's exactly. That cross-pollinization so that if we're doing, like Richard was telling me, we're going to do another set with Gray Water Action and Ecology Center and et cetera on you know, gray water workshops that we, you know, sort of cross pollinate that.
Yes, that is the plan.
I think you've done a phenomenal job. Thank you. One thing I noticed, heard on the radio driving in this morning that Facebook is supposed to plateau this year on users. It's actually going to go down. So we might want to start looking at other medians, especially for the younger people, because they're the ones who can deliver the message, and that's. Those are the ones who are not going on Facebook or leaving Facebook and going on other sources of, so we may want to be cognizant of that and look at going into those as well.
Yes. This is, I will agree with you, and I think that our plan is to continue to measure and monitor, and our social media policy enables us to then move a bit between platforms because I do expect they'll taper off.
Yeah, they're basically saying anybody who's on Facebook is old now. And all they do is share photos of their grandkids. And so if you're under 25, that's not the market to go to anymore.
Yeah. Thank you.
Who is they?
All of us.
Doug?
Do we have a target audience that we're trying to reach in particular? I mean, is it our customers? Or I think I read somewhere it's people who have above average interest in water issues or something, but how would you try and define that?
I think for me, for my group, when I try and look at what East Bay Mud should be doing in terms of outreach, we should be trying to reach everyone in our service area in some, you know, whatever age group. Frankly, we are working on some items with relation to K-12 education because that is the foundation upon which that people understand a system and then grow into adults who will be faced with bills and rates and other things. So to me, the universe is large. I think that we want to reach everyone in our service area. I think we have to be concerned with the Bay Area being in the media market and the competition that you find here. You need to be present in order to be, you know, acknowledged and to be seen, I think. So we're dealing with a Bay Area media market, which means we're putting messages out in many ways. So I'm trying to reach, I think, from a younger group all the way up to older. We use all these pieces, our, you know, bill insert newsletter that may reach those who get a paper bill, making sure that we're reaching people on next door, making sure we're using the social media mechanisms and doing in-person meetings and conversations. So I wouldn't target a specific group on any of these messages necessarily, except to make sure that we're trying to reach, be cognizant of that whole audience of people that all participate in some way in what we deliver.
So. And what about, I'm less familiar with Facebook, but I use Twitter a lot. Are we targeting following certain people, or, you know, that's one way also to get followers is to follow
someone else. Right. Some of the steps that we're going to be looking at in order to grow our followers in these coming months, because it has been a process here to make sure we had good content and a good stream of information going on and managing any interactions. Now the next step is to take some more aggressive actions to get some more followers and to find mechanisms that we can actions we can take that are no cost, as well as the ads. We have a number of people that we follow. A lot of them are the cities and other entities within the service area that are, you know, Water Education Foundation as well. So there's a lot. I don't have a full list. We could always give you one if you'd like. But we do follow quite a number, and I think we're looking at this being the next step. How else can we continue to work on reminding folks to follow us and highlighting this content so that people will find our face that way?
The thought of following cities is very interesting. That would be a great partnership.
You could follow the president, and then you're going to 42 million people.
Only if he retweets us. we do try. I will confirm this, but I believe we follow all the cities, and we try and do...
Within our jurisdiction?
Yeah, okay. And we try and cross-post anything that might have an impact in that area mm-hmm. so that we can then amplify that message.
That's great.
Right.
Yeah, I think, Allison, you guys are doing a good job moving into this. And in particular, it gives people a peek into our operational end to see who works in East Bay Mud and what their work is about. And I think getting involved in social media is a good thing because they see the real news, not the fake. And we're not in it to advertise for any of that, but really to, I like to say, tell stories about how we make accomplishments. And many of them are unique. I'm not a real follower of all this stuff, but I've been clicking it on and taking a little look-see, as you can tell. And that's helpful because I think the generation we have out there now, the ones who are coming, this is their game. So they're in the middle of it all the time. I even see my son comes home, first thing he does, jump on the computer and stays on there until he goes to sleep. I'm saying, I don't understand. That's the reason I resent it, because it takes up all your time,
yeah.
See? But I'm saying, for those who live by it, and I wonder, I said, what about the girlfriend? When are you going to do this or that? You know, I raise questions. I'm old school. but I would say by the same token, that media has now really got the majority of people in its grasp. And if we don't make a dent in it, if we're not in it, then we're out. So let's be in. Keep on going.
Thank you. Okay.
Great direction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, Andy.
So I also am very impressed with the development of this program. I think it's been a wonderful way of getting out our key messages into the community. And I remember that when this first got started, that the board, you know, had some concerns about, you know, how things would work out. And I think we're cautiously optimistic. And I'm definitely glad to see the quality of the visual content that's being developed and the precision of a lot of the messaging. I think that it's important to know moving forward that the architecture of different platforms have very, very big differences. Twitter is particularly simple, although it's very fast moving and live. And you know, I'm just as impressed at some of the ways of designing responses for the kinds of negative responses that can come up from customers and people in the community. It sounds like there must be a lot of, I would hope that there is a lot of training and deliberation about how to prepare for those kinds of messages that are predictable. So I would comment it while moving forward just to pay close attention to the uniqueness of the architecture of some of the new platforms that we would be participating in so that we can proactively identify policies that can guide our staff ahead of time so that we don't have questions in the moment that could lead to different interpretations of what was the right decision. So I'd like to be able to have our team work together in a way where you can participate and give appropriate direction and consult with the teams, both within public affairs as well as throughout the district, so that we can prepare in advance. One silly example is tagging. You know, on Facebook, accounts can be tagged in a particular way, in a photo, in a post, and you can moderate that. You can accept the tag or hide the tag. There's a lot more layers of conversation. So these are, there's no right answer, but there are probably some wrong answers. So I definitely applaud the endeavor and I look forward to the next update. I think those summarize my feedback.
Great. Thank you. And I do want to just add, I want to thank the staff, public affairs, also other the water agencies that meet regionally. Social media conversations are a pretty frequent discussion. We've done some emergency trainings with the counties that have focused on sort of using social media in that response. So it's been a great platform to share information. But I thank you for the comments, and we'll be tracking that and making sure that we've got it well covered.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, just a few short items here. There's a monthly report in your packet. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to work to answer them. There was an information memo in the packet that I wanted to draw your attention to. At the next board meeting, we're going to begin a pilot project to make the recordings that we take of this meeting available online. There'll be a link on our webpage right next to where you find agenda and board meeting materials. So just be careful what you say next time. We have Speaker's Bureau updated. And then just for a final comment, I just wanted to, because in part, we get often folks who express concerns, I just thought I'd try to get in the practice of maybe reading one bit of information that we get from customers that says something positive about employees. And so this comes from Lafayette Reservoir visitor Mike Collis, who sends a thank you to senior ranger naturalist Andrea Lorando. And he writes, "I just want to say a huge thank you to the staff at the Lafayette Visitor Center, always cheerful, helpful, and friendly. When my battery failed on a fishing trip yesterday, Annie drove me out to help pick up my stuff. No drama, no judgment, just plain helpful. Great job, you guys. Thank you." So just want to start sharing positive stuff.
All right. Please submit items for future consideration to the general manager. Director's comments.
I've submitted mine. Just so the board is aware, I did tell Alex already. Thursday evening, McCullamy Hill is a wild and scenic river meeting being put on by the California Department of Natural Resources Agency. I'm going to attend it. I'm not going to speak at it. I'm up there just to listen and gauge what's happening.
And that meeting is here, correct?
No, Thursday at 6:30 at McCullamy Hill, I think.
It's upcountry. Okay.
There will be one here on the 26th.
Yeah.
Or the 26th, the 24th, 26th.
26th is a Monday, the day before our next board meeting.
All right. Okay.
And if you're interested in attending, please let the secretary know so that if we have more than a quorum, we can post it as appropriate.
All right. With that, we are adjourned, returning here at 1:15 on Tuesday, February 27th for our next meeting.
Let's not forget the...